Nero. Occhio destro dominante.
Right eye dominant.
Rechtes Auge dominant.
Right eye dominant.
Høyre øye dominant.
Right eye dominant.
Align the lumna almuhaimina to.
Right eye dominant.
This is the Right Eye Dominant podcast.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Right Eye Dominant podcast. I am your host, Nick Toro Jr. If you are a regular listener to this podcast, you probably noticed that I have a passion not only for photography, but also music. And I've spoken to several photographers who've bridged the gap between these two worlds. Today's episode is another installment, I guess, in this little sort of run of music photography episodes that I've been having from time to time. My guest today is Michael Greco. Michael is a commercial and portrait photographer, also a filmmaker. But way back in the day, the late 1970s, early 1980s, when Michael was a young man, he was wandering the clubs of Boston, Massachusetts with his camera and taking photographs of the burgeoning punk rock and alternative music worlds that were just getting a foothold at that time. So if I rattle off just some of the acts that Michael has photographed, you'll see exactly why I wanted to talk to him today. They include Adam Ant, Billy Idol, The Cramps, The Ramones, Devo, The Buzzcocks, Killing Joke, The Slits, and The Clash, amongst many, many others. Michael is revisiting this archive of photographs that he has created and is now releasing it to the world via a book, exhibit, and selling prints. And I thought it would be just really great to talk music and photography with somebody who shares an interest and a passion in a lot of the same groups that I do. So I reached out to Michael. He agreed to this interview, and that's where we're going with today's episode. Just a little warning that we do get down and dirty in talking a little bit about the scene. There's definitely references to drug use and profanities and everything else that you would expect from the music scene of that time. So I guess I don't know if anyone actually listens to this podcast with young people, but maybe this is a PG-13 episode. So without further ado, let's get into it. Here's my conversation with photographer Michael Greco. Hey ho, let's go. Welcome to the Right Eye Dominant podcast, Michael Greco.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, Michael, to start off, maybe you could just tell me a little bit about how you discovered photography way back when, and sort of like your journey to photography. I know you're a professional photographer, so why don't you just give us a little bit of a background of your experience?
Well, I was in college, and I was always into photography since I was a little kid, like 12 or 13, had my first camera, learned the darkroom in a summer camp in the science shack, and mm-hmm. learned how to print and develop film and things like that. I was always into it, would go into the Greenberg Public Library and steal their Time Inc. On photography library, you know, those Time Inc. collections.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, they're like 12 books. And I learned photography by looking at Irving Penn and Bruce Davidson and Richard Avedon and Dwayne Michaels. And so I was always into photography. And then I went to school in Boston, which was like just far enough away from my parents that I was still in a city. I went to school in Boston and studied filmmaking, because of course as a 18-year-old you think you know it all and you don't need to study photography, and because you know everything about photography at 18. So I studied filmmaking and then took a photojournalism course and thought, this is kind of cool because you get to do things, you get to meet people, you get to, you know. So I took this photojournalism course and got into it. It was like join the Navy, see the world. If anyone remembers, if any of our audience remembers those ads. So, you know, it was like I got to be with the governor. I started interning for the Associated Press and right during the blizzard in 1978 in Boston, there was two tremendous storms that dumped like 6 feet of snow successively in the city, and everything froze because wow. They had no place to put the snow. They plowed once, covered all the cars, and then had no place to plow and put the snow again. So it was 2 weeks before my internship was supposed to start with the Associated Press, and I'm a skier. So I skied into the office with two rolls of film, and I got my first picture on the wire in January of 78, and I never looked back. And you know, eventually it caught up with me that artistically my heart wasn't into photojournalism. I much more wanted to be the creative portrait guy, you know, influenced by early on by Annie Leibovitz and you know, some of Irving Penn's work and Avedon. And so I really wanted to be a different type of photographer, but I had started there, and it wound up being the first 13 years of my career. I went from the Associated Press to a staff job at the Boston Herald to an invite to become, you know, what would be staff at People Magazine. And I came out to LA to work for People Magazine. And then after like 3 or 4 years of that and covering events and assignments that were very photojournalistic, and I really had to make the switch into creative portraiture. But, you know, what that taught me is, I think, Nick, what you and the audience is most interested in, I was a photojournalist by day, learning from, you know, some amazing Associated Press photographers, David Tenenbaum and Chip Morey, who was like a 3-time military photographer of the year, you know, award-winning photographers. And at night, I was a club kid. So I had all my chops of good photojournalism. And at night, I was out in the clubs. I was into the music that was, you know, that was there at the time. I was, you know, that was my scene.
Yeah.
So, you know, I was really a music snob growing up in New York, and decided that I would, punk was like jazz in a way. It was creative, and it was, you know, it was disruptive, and it was, you know, or at least the jazz I listened to.
Yeah.
And right. I started taking assignments. I started working for WBCN, which was the K-Rock station in Boston, and Boston Rock Magazine and that sort of thing. So I took those skills and put them into something I was just really into.
Yeah. Well, that's thank you for the sort of the backstory and yeah, jumping into the, you know, the punk photograph. So it one of the things that struck me when I first saw the work was clearly you had access to areas. I mean, yes, like, as you said, you were a club kid. You were going to go to those shows probably anyway. But it's interesting. So you were shooting on assignment for those, like you said, the radio station or that publication. Was that like a press pass, or was that kind of getting you into those areas? Because there's a lot of intimate sort of environmental photographs in that body of work. And it just seems like, just was curious of like how you sort of navigated those areas.
Well, I mean, I was into the music, and I was friends with all the DJs, and being a club kid, I was at the clubs every night, either the Rat Skeller, which was the Rat, which was our CBGBs, or Spit. And all my buddies were the DJs, and all my buddies were the DJs at the radio stations, and all my buddies. So almost all of them were assignments, but when I walked into a backstage area, they knew I was cool and part of the scene.
Right.
You know, because the DJs would be back there also. And it's like, hey, how are you? Hey, Michael, you know, blah, blah, blah. But also a lot of these assignments, it was like, all right, the Buzzcocks are in town, 1980, doing their first concert in the United States. And, you know, Boston has an interesting history because it's the first show of every tour. Even if you're a U.S. band like Devo, you get a record deal, your first show's in Boston. And I think it's partly practical and partly laziness on the record company guys who would set up the dates because, you know, they had their thing locked down, right? You would go to Boston, Providence, Yale, and New Haven, and then you would be warmed up for New York.
Right, right.
Where the executives would hear a showcase, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. Then if it was the winter, you would drop all the way down the East Coast, go across the South, back up to California, maybe to Portland or Seattle. And then by the summertime, you would cut across. If it was the summer, you would do just the opposite. You would cut across the North. You'd go through Chicago and da-da-da-da-da and go down. And, you know, whatever those routes, they all started in Boston.
Yeah.
So I would spend, for Boston Rock, I would spend, like if we take the Buzzcocks or Adam Ant as an example, I would spend all day as they went from radio station to radio station promoting their show. So I would follow them. I would take the Buzzcocks back to their hotel room. I would, you know, I would hang out with them. And then I'd be at the show and a friend of mine would be shooting video and he'd pass me a video camera. And I was on stage with the band because they had already spent the day with me.
Right. You know? Right.
And then they, you know, it was like, all right, where's the after party? And we'd create an after party. And, you know, I had a couple of rules. I didn't really like shoot the personal stuff at an after party and the cocaine use and the heavy drinking and all of that, you know, but I was certainly involved in intimate moments with these bands.
Yeah. So, and that's, I can imagine just like that opportunity. So like, and as you described earlier, you know, they knew you were cool, you know, you were kind of in that world already anyway. So it wasn't like you were perceived as like an outsider necessarily, or like, even the way you describe sort of like the warm-up shows, because I grew up in New Jersey, and so I would go see, probably, you know, I'm a little younger than you, but I would see the sort of the shows as they would make their way to New York, and it would made perfect sense to that was kind of the route that they would take. So but it's also interesting to me that you being, you know, into the music and into that scene, and just like what a cool opportunity to, like, you know, even if it's just like a day or 2 days spent with these musicians and really kind of like tagging along, but also being sort of like, you know, that's your town, they're a stranger in that town. I would imagine just that dynamic was probably really, no pun intended, intoxicating, maybe, to be in that world.
You know, so I was sort of a jazz snob as a kid in New York, and kind of like listened to, you know, Art Ensemble of Chicago and, you know, avant-garde jazz people, Anthony Braxton and Sam Rivers, and, you know, really like the out there music, because the radio at the time was terrible. It was all 70s was all produced, record company produced bands. It was like, all right, we're going to make a lot of money. We're going to hedge our bets. We're going to find incredible musicians, and we're going to have someone else write songs for them. And then we're going to do like audience surveys to figure out, you know, if the songs are good. You know, it became so convoluted and so bullshit. You know, and you had bands like Rush, Journey, Kansas, Styx, Boston, you know, and the music sucked. And I mean, there were outliers that I was into as a kid. I was hugely into the Velvet Underground and Lou Reed, and hugely into Patti Smith and Bowie, you know, started listening to them in high school, you know. But the telltale was like, just as I was graduating high school, a friend of mine, we were at my friend Adam's house, and he brought the Ramones record in. And he's like, check this out. beat on the brat, beat on the brat, beat on the brat with a baseball bat. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm like, whoa. You know, of course, we were all smoking pot at the time.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Whatever it was. But so I was already predisposed to be into whatever was different and whatever was artistic and whatever was groundbreaking and, you know, avant-garde, so to speak.
Yeah.
So it, you know, it was a natural fit for me. And it was also a very accepting culture. Like, if you were friends there, it didn't matter if you were gay, straight, you know, Lou Miami from Boston, you know, who dressed up as a woman when he performed. Like, it didn't. It was a very accepting culture that I found acceptance in. So yeah, I was a part of it, and you know, we were always hanging out. Billy Idol would have Ace Penna, his road manager, call me. Billy's in town. He wants to see you. There's two tickets there. You know, come backstage. He wants to hang out afterwards. It's like same with the Buzzcocks and having this after party. And it took me, I was so naive at the time, though. It took me 20 years to realize that Pete Shelley was giving me his phone number and address and kept trying to make sure I came to England to come visit him. And I didn't realize he was bisexual and he was hitting on me. It's like, I was so naive. It was like, oh shit. He was hitting on me. but I had like Adam and the Ants, two drummers, Chris and Merrick, over my house all night, spinning records, doing blow, drinking. Like, you know, we all felt like we were part of this underground, avant-garde, rebellious music. You know, I had Chris and Merrick over till 5 or 6 at night. And hey, have you heard the new Mekons record? Hey, the new Modets album is really cool. It's like, you know, you were turning everyone on to different things and they were turning you on to something. And you know, it was great.
Yeah, that I'm trying to sort of like picture that sort of like, you know, obviously times being so different now and sort of like, you know, way pre-internet or like, you know, like these sort of pockets of, you know, those kinds of communities. I think like I would imagine, especially, you know, the bands that were coming over from England, like finding like-minded people on the other side of the pond, right, in Boston, and like immediately having that common ground. And I remember experiencing this as well, because I had friends who moved to my hometown from Ireland, and it was like introduction to things like that they kind of like were aware of and I had never heard of. It wasn't in, you know, like it was like obscure bands that from another country that I wouldn't have ever been introduced to. It's not like you could just like, you couldn't have jumped on like YouTube and watch a video or have somebody right. like send you something. So I would imagine that a lot of that, as you described, that sharing, that reciprocation between you and them made it more sort of like, in essence, level the playing field. It wasn't like these are sort of like, you know, like exclusive sort of untouchable stars who just kind of show up on the scene and you don't have access to them. They're just real people, real young people, you know, in the same place that you were in.
Well, I grew up in New York, and back when I grew up, the driver's licenses didn't have pictures on them. So, and Massachusetts was like one of the first states to raise the drinking age because of so many colleges. So they might have raised the drinking age originally to like 19 or 20. And The Cure played their first show ever in the United States at a little place called The Underground. It was literally a basement apartment, a one bedroom with a big like living room, basement apartment. And then the bands played in the bedroom. Like, you know, it was a decent size, but it was still an apartment, if you can think about how big the club is. So I was there to see them because I'm a big fan. And I was there to see them, and the drummer couldn't get in. So I have Richie Parsons of the Unnatural Acts like, hey, because he knew I had this New York State license. He's like, hey, can we borrow your license so the drummer can get into the club?
That's awesome. Yeah.
So, and that happened with, I think, John, the drummer of the Buzzcocks, too. They wound up borrowing my license so he can get into the Bradford Ballroom and perform.
Wow. Yeah.
So it was like we were a community. We helped the bands. We, you know, my friends would open for them when U2 played The Paradise. I didn't shoot it. It's kind of now that I've done the book, I wish I had shot all those shows that I went to see and didn't shoot. The Smiths and the Psych Furs and who else? The U2, the first show at the Paradise, the first show in the United States. So, you know, I wish I had shot it, but I was at all those shows. I was at, you know, U2's first performance in the United States. And my friends, Tristram and Robbie, were in a band called The Someone and the Somebodies. They opened for them.
Awesome. Yeah. I think some of our timeline between your, like I said, you're a few years older, but like I, you know, remember hitting those, like those first wave of like, not the punk bands, but sort of the next, I don't like saying new wave, but like that sort of era when those bands started making their way into New York and like the Psychedelic Furs, the U2, the, I remember U2 played, I think they played on St. Patrick's Day in New York on that first tour, if I'm not mistaken. And it was just like, there's this sort of, you know, like aura around a lot of those bands and those moments. And just to be, I mean, I love talking about this stuff with people who were actually there and participated and witnessed it because it's, and I think like, it's interesting to me, like I work in an office, we have some younger people and like, we have the Spotify on and like, they'll be playing songs of stuff that I was like, oh, you like the Smiths. It's cool to kind of, you know, but like there's the disconnect. They don't have that sort of personal history with it, but it's still, you know, and then like, oh yeah, I saw the Smiths like five times, you know, back in the day. And it's like, you know, maybe it's just kind of an ego stroke of like some coolness, right. Credibility, but right. You actually, right. What I'm envious of is that you've got like photo evidence of your, you know, your, your street cred. I want to talk a little bit more about, so like, without getting, you know, the gory details, you did allude to some, you know, drug use and drinking. And that obviously is part of the rock experience. And it's interesting how you said like, there, you know, you were respectful and you're not going to, you know, take photographs at that time, but like, can you just tell some interesting, maybe behind the scenes stories, just crazy stuff that you remember?
Yeah. I mean, so the thing to keep in mind, which I was going to add, you know, when answering the last question is we had incredible access, right? So the if you think about it, you know, we have bands that are on the outskirts, you know, they're either with independent labels or blah blah blah, that it's not, you know, it's not Taylor Swift. It's a band hoping to get airplay, hoping to get people interested, hoping, you know. And the interesting thing to keep in mind is we never, like, we didn't care if these bands would live on or not. Mm. We didn't know if they would or not. We just liked the music.
Yeah.
But you have these indie bands, you had people who were accepting of them, so that gave you a ton of access, right? You know, when Lux Interior, you know, there's a picture in the book, I have a book came out a couple of years ago and we've had museum shows of this work. The project is called Days of Punk. Mm-hmm. So, and everything's on the daysofpunk.com website. But the book is called Punk, Post-Punk, New Wave, On Stage, Backstage, In Your Face, 1978 to 1991. And, you know, if you look at the book and you look at, you know, like one of my two favorite shows to shoot were The Cramps and The Dead Kennedys. And if you're looking at the pictures of The Cramps, you know, Lux's pants fall off. So, you know, and if you look at the book too, you see how many times I'm trying to make portraits and not just doing documentary photography. And that's sort of a prelude to my interest in being a portrait photographer, right? So I would always go backstage, let's do a portrait, this and that. I do that signature portrait of Poison Ivy with her hands, you know, it's at the beginning of the book with her hands right up around her eyes. That's like my favorite picture from the project. Then you're backstage and it's like, hey, Lux, let me take your portrait. And he lost his pants. So he goes and gets a hot dog bun from the catering tray and puts his dick in the hot dog bun. So it's like, you know, there was a sense of irreverence all the time.
Yeah.
And also a sense of like being rebels and, you know, so it was a time, and that doesn't really happen anymore.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
Justin Bieber is not going to go get a hot dog bun and stick his dick in it for a portrait.
No, that's not going to happen.
But if I think about it, it's like at the time I was dealing a little bit of coke to like make ends meet. If you have to realize that these assignments from the Associated Press, I would get paid $25 to go to an assignment and wow, all the film I can take out of the film cabinet. So I would take all that film and use it for the punk stuff. And I got paid like $15 or $25 from Boston Rock Magazine. So I wasn't really making ends meet. I would peddle a little bit, a small amount of coke. And so it also, I mean, I realized it's like, all right, I've done lines with Johnny Rotten. I've done lines with The Clash. I've done lines with Adam and the Ants. I've done, not Adam, but Chris and Merrick. And, you know, I've done many lines with Billy, who Idol, who was, you know, I tell a story in the book where I get a call from Ace and he's like, Billy wants to see you and hang out. So I go up to New Hampshire where he's playing. He's playing in Portsmouth at a club on the beach, and I'm backstage and he comes screaming backstage, "You're my mate and you can't take pictures all the time." And he grabs a metal milk crate and flings it at my head, literally.
Holy shit.
I almost wet my pants. My heart's beating. The metal milk crate breaks the sheetrock and sticks in the wall next to me. I look up and said, "What?" He goes, "Your girlfriend keeps asking to take pictures and you're my mate and we're just hanging out." I looked up and said, "Billy, I don't have a girlfriend." And Billy goes, "Oh, shit." And he goes back into the dressing room. He really was upset. Like, I really, he realizes, like, you know, and in one way, I appreciated our friendship. But he goes back in. Bill O'Coin, his manager, comes out with a gallon bag of cocaine. Now, not a gallon bag where there's a little bit at the bottom, like a gallon bag your grandmother would put brisket in and fill it before you went away to college because she wanted to make sure, or your mother, you had enough to eat. Right. So he comes back out. Bill O'Coin comes back out with this gallon bag of coke. And he goes, "Billy feels really sorry. Do you want a line?" I said, "Bill, my heart is about to like pop out of my chest as it is. No, I'm okay for right now."
The picture that you just painted there is just so amazing. But like, I'm also just literally trying to like figure out like the value of that, like that bag of cocaine. That's crazy. But I, you know, like as you said, I mean, like it was, you know, I mean, like that was the drug of choice at that time for sure. And it definitely played into, you know, not just like the rock and roll lifestyle, but specifically the punk energy was few. I know like speed was a big sort of, you know, drug of choice prior.
But yeah, so you know, I when you're hanging out with rock stars or people who later became rock stars, you know, anything could happen.
Yeah. So can we talk a little bit about, were there moments where, like, as you said, there, you were there, you were enjoying the music, you're part of the scene, you're not, you know, in some ways, witnessing sort of like people who would then move on and become huge stars, or you know, popular figures.
Well, the interesting thing, and we can remove the bands who broke up, like Human League, you know, even though they had a hit. But the interesting thing is, like, most of them survived. Like, most of them, you know. Most of them have, you know, a still have a following. As you said, people are getting back into them. Yeah. Like a lot of them, you know, not the Mekons and the Modettes and, you know, the bands on the edge. Mm-hmm. Right. But certainly, you know, U2, the Police, Psych Furs, The Cure, The Ramones, like, you know,
these are all legends, long careers.
Yeah. And we had no idea if they would remain or not, you know what I mean?
Well, let me ask, cause this is kind of where I was going with that. Were there any performers early on that you were like, this person's going to be huge, like this, they just got it. There's something.
Well, right from the get-go, I wasn't a big fan of the Police just because they were a little too poppy for me.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But you sort of knew that, you know, early on they had so many hits. The band, you know, both The Cure and U2, I owned their first albums as UK imports.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I would walk into, my editor at Boston Rock was a DJ at you know, we had the very first punk radio show in the world, by the way, in Boston. 75, my friend Oedipus, my dear friend Oedipus, started Nocturnal Emission on the MIT station, WTBS, which became WMBR. And then they started a daily morning punk radio show from 9 to 12 called The Late Risers Club. And everyone, that was organized by a guy named Tom Lane. So Tom had a show. My friends Albert Oram, Albert O, and Carla Nolan had a show. Greg Reedman had a show, you know, and Greg was also the editor at Boston Rock. So I would walk in to, and Boston Rock was produced by Newbury Comics. So I, down the street was Newbury Comics. I lived on Newbury Street, and I would walk in and go, all right, Greg, what do I buy this week? What's the hap, you know? He's like, oh, this album from U2 is pretty good. And you sort of knew that they would make it.
Mm.
Like the album had, it was interesting enough musically and at the same time had enough hooks. And, you know, the production, I forget whether that, I think that was Steve Lillywhite.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
So, like, it was brilliant. Then October came out, and everyone's like, oh, this is a one hit wonder band, and, you know, one album wonder. And I'm like, no, this is not. U2 is not a one album wonder. The Cure, I was a little more surprised about because the first album was so dark and moody.
Yeah. You know,
killing an Arab and jumping someone else's train. And it was like really brooding and dark. So, but I loved those albums. I was into Sartre. I was into, you know, that whole album has this existential kind of quality to it, you know, and is based on, you know, Sartre's manifesto of existentialism. So we didn't know, you know, and some things turned out, like the Psychedelic Furs, that first album with India on it.
Mm-hmm.
was brilliant. And mm-hmm. then they do Pretty in Pink and everyone's like, oh yeah, it's that pop band. It's sure. like, no, you really, yeah. Same thing with Simple Minds.
Yeah. Right.
Reel to Reel Cacophony was freaking brilliant. So
yeah. Yeah.
There were a lot of bands like that.
Yeah. And well, and what it's an interesting, a couple of things that you're bringing up is first of all, even bands, you know, like you were saying, like Psychedelic Furs, I would say even The Cure to a certain extent, Simple Minds, OMD, even like, you know, their very early stuff maybe indicated it's, you know, maybe to varying degrees a pop sensibility, but the bands that really went all in on sort of like, you know, like, you know, like movie soundtrack hits and, you know, Don't You Forget About Me. And like to the, those songs compared to, like you said, those first few Simple Minds albums, it's just, it's almost hard to imagine like being around and sort of digesting that and witnessing those early performances and then kind of see where, you know, those bands kind of ended up. But you also were talking about The Cure and that, for, you know, to a certain extent, they always stayed in like this dark place, obviously, but
yeah, and that became cute, much more popular,
which right. And, right, which always I remember I can't, like, because I was younger, I came to The Cure a little later, but like even like the Pornography or the Top album was just some
I was at their first show in the United States,
man. Yeah, so like that is like it's if you told me that same band, then like I would be like at Madison Square Garden with, you know, 20,000 people, seeing them just a few years later.
Yeah.
Did not really I wouldn't have believed it. And yep. So it is sort of like, and you mentioned, yes, The Police, you know, I mean, I think Sting always had that sort of, you know, I mean, all three of them probably had, you know, very strong intentions on being successful, but like Sting definitely had star quality. I even think Bono, even way back at the beginning, Bono definitely had that quality. Like you could just, like, you could see him on stage and know that, did you see, he was, had that charisma, or, and he was enigmatic, or, you know, like there was something about him. So it's in some ways, not so much a surprise, you know, and then, you know, there's pitfalls and challenges along the way, but clearly they're, you know.
Yeah. I mean, the interesting thing is most of them made it, like, you know, aside from, like I said, the outlier weird bands.
Yeah.
You know, the Mekons, which,
yeah, the music
and
nerd,
the Modettes,
yeah, the music nerd bands that
the Au Pairs. I thought the Au Pairs were amazing, but you kind of knew they weren't going to make it. They were sort of the cool artsy side of it,
right?
But most of the bands that we listened to, even though we didn't care at the time, made it. But even Devo, you would think Devo was like a one trick band, right?
Right.
They went on to make some great music.
And that, and if you were seeing them early on in their career, that it was like, that was definitely transgressive stuff that they were doing. So, yeah,
they played the first show of their tour once they had a record deal at the Paradise in Boston. I was there.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
all of those images are in punk, post-punk, new wave, on stage, backstage, in your face.
Good segue. Let's talk about the life of the book. And you did say, I I've seen on your website, it's been exhibited. It continues to be exhibited. Tell me a little bit about like bringing that project to life and sort of where it's gone since you sort of structured it the way you have.
Well, after shooting for 45 years, the industry has changed so much, where essentially, you know, when everyone has an iPhone camera, there's no more value. They don't really value good photography. So, you know, instead of beating my head against the wall trying to get assignments where no one has a budget, I've sort of moved into legacy building. Like, I, you know, I have a 45-year archive. We're working on licensing it. We protect it from infringements. I'm working on my fifth book with a major gallery here in Los Angeles. Which means having like a huge project of having to edit and scan the whole archive. I have 14 four drawer file cabinets filled with film and negatives and slides. So that's my focus at this point. And that comes with two things, right? The building the provenance of the work, whether it's the punk work or later the celebrity book I'm working on, through museum shows and things like that, because that just builds the stature of the work. And then, you know, increasing the footprint for galleries so that you've got as big a footprint as possible and you start selling prints, right? I'm writing myself a note as we speak to reach out to a gallery. But so it, you know, that's my focus. It's legacy building and going out into the fine art market, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, what I do, like, you know, if someone reached out and wanted me to go on tour with a band, I would do that because that's kind of cool if I like the band. What I did in the second half of my career, you know, after the photojournalism days, was really like conceptual set building, you know, type of shoot that had an idea behind it, but also needed a budget.
Yeah.
And those just don't happen anymore. I mean, right. I had a stylist or makeup artist just tell me, yeah, so-and-so, you know, some big client of hers, a big celebrity. She's like, don't you miss those days of those big shoots where everyone got dressed up well and, you know, it was at a great location? And, you know, and when that doesn't happen for the celebrity, that doesn't happen for, you know. I mean, there is that 0.5% of photographers, the Steven Meisel and Mark Seliger and Annie that are still, you know, that are still doing it. But, you know, other than Annie, I think I'm older than Mark, and, you know, I've just been at it a long time. So
yeah.
I have other interests. I'm both right-brained and left-brained and like the business side also. So,
yeah. So, I will definitely share links, not only to, you know, the website, but also where people could get their hands on copy of the book. So, I think this is a good place to wrap up, Michael. I'm jealous in a lot of ways that I wasn't born a little sooner, to hear the stories and to look at the photo evidence of your time back then. It just was, it's so cool. And I really appreciate you taking the time out for, you know, this conversation today.
I'm happy to be here and I'm happy to be a part of it.
Awesome, man. All right. Well, good talking with you, man. Good to meet you, and take it easy.
Thank you.
So there you go, folks. My conversation with photographer Michael Greco, taking a little jaunt back to the late 1970s, early 1980s music scene, punk rock, new wave, and everything that came after it. It was just so cool to hear from somebody who witnessed so much of musical history that I really value. He witnessed it firsthand and really was excited that he agreed to chat with me today. I will definitely share links to Michael's work, where you can find the book, where you could find prints, and just dive in much deeper into this world of photography that Michael created. Also, I will, of course, share more images that Michael produced on the Instagram account for Right Eye Dominant. And if you want to go to the website, righteyedominantpodcast.com, you'll find all of my episodes listed there. As well, if you scroll all the way down to the bottom, you can find a spot where you could send me feedback. Any questions you might have, I always love to hear from listeners. And then, of course, lastly, if you haven't already, I would love it if you would leave a review or a rating wherever you find your podcasts. So that's it for this episode. This has been the Right Eye Dominant Podcast. I've been your host, Nick Toro Jr. And until next time, stay well.
This podcast has been a production of righteyedominant.art. The sounds and music from this episode are courtesy of The Conant Project and Yazar.